Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk with Rayford Davis again. He's a former cop turned libertarian and anti-militarization activist. And I think he said it's his old police department that's featured in this video that was released by the New York Times last night. If you're on Twitter, then you know. I think it's getting around. A guy named Walter Scott shot in the back by a cop while he's running away. Cop actually charged with murder. Can you believe that? Well, let me know if he's actually convicted. But it was just blatant. The cop's just standing there like it's target practice. No struggle. Just a cold-blooded murder. Anyway, so Rayford's going to be here to talk a little bit about this. He does say, let's see. Yeah, it's his old police department, North Charleston. His old police department he's going to be on. Talk about this. So that'd be cool. I think. And then I got a couple more invites out. I don't know what's going to happen, but I got plenty of news to cover. As every day. More news than I can get to, especially with all the ranting and raving that comes with it. But, of course, the ISIS war, the Iran deal, and the war against it, and the Congress, and all the rest of this stuff. And then check this out. Is this the LA Times story republished? Yeah, okay. At stripes.com, Stars and Stripes, they have reprinted Justin Raimondo's article that he wrote for the LA Times. Can you believe that? Eric says here, this must be the first time they've ever mentioned the term antiwar.com at Stars and Stripes. But Justin wrote this for the LA Times, and they've reprinted it now. Need clarity on Stand with Rand slogan. Where's that? Asks Justin. And then goes through example after example after example of major flip-flops on Iran, on Iraq, on Russia, on Palestine. And, yeah, imagine that. Okay, well, good. I won't waste any more of the show after this segment talking about Rand. I promise. I hope. I'm pretty sure. But did you see him on the Today Show this morning? I admit I turned it off about halfway through because I saw all I needed to see in order to comment my comment that I was going to say. And that is that, well, now I kind of don't want to call him that. I'll make it a rhetorical question. What's the matter with this guy? He's running for president. As he answers in the first question, the confluence of, the alignment of circumstances that have allowed him to even try to run for the presidency of the United States means that he's in a pretty special spot, man. He's a senator running for president. And then, so what's his attitude toward lowly old Today Show host? Is basically like, hey, shut up while I'm talking, lady. And the thing of it is, yeah, she was being kind of a jerk because she was, auditioning for Tough Guy or whatever at her TV station there. Look at me. I ask tough questions of the people that you'd say I should ask tough questions of. And so she had said like one thing snarky, but then the rest was him. And instead of, you could just imagine, it's so easy to imagine his father in the same place. He'd have just laughed and said, like, okay, well, whatever. Let me know when you're done. Whatever, it's fine. So he doesn't get bothered. But Rand gets all thin-skinned, let's call it. I think maybe this is as much my problem with him as everything else. I just don't like him. I love Ron Paul. That guy's got charisma. He's got that beautiful kind of anti-charisma. Really, actually genuine, not manipulative, not an act in any way. Just, he's a kind old man, and he's so damn honest that you can see right through him and like him anyway. But Rand, I just don't like him. And also, coincidentally, he's horrible on a lot of policies. And for that matter, he's stupid. He thinks he's going to sell this strategy of being everything to everyone and put together some grand coalition. When everybody that he's given half a sop to, he's only angering everybody else. And he's only reinforcing the message that he flip-flops all over the damn place. There's actually an article in The Week by that I saw the American Conservative linking to. I don't know if they were being ironic or not. But it was by that guy from The Atlantic, or no, the guy that used to be at the New Republic that I hate so much. Not Jonathan Chait. I forget his name. This weasel from the New Republic. Used to be, anyway, whatever. And he wrote this thing. The best thing about Rand Paul is he doesn't believe in anything, and nobody knows where he stands on anything. And so he'll be a great candidate, because as he's shifting his position all the time, that will make everyone else have to be nimble and think of new things to say or something. No, it won't. Just means that he's reinforcing the one thing that all different factions will be able to agree on. They don't know what he stands for other than himself and his own ambition. And they know that if he says that he agrees with them on whatever it is, that he'll flip right over and stab him in the back tomorrow. Yeah, what a great way to build a grand coalition. Not by being honest and leading, but by pandering to all opposite factions at the same time. Anyway, stupid Rand. And then his real problem is he's just a jerk. You know? And her only question was, hey, look, you used to say that Iran was no big deal, and now you say it is. You used to say this, and now you say that. And he wants to lie. That was why he got all angry at her. It was because he wants to lie and say, I never said that. Well, come on, it's in PDF format. His initial budget cut all foreign aid, including to Israel, and was specific about it. What is the point in him continuing to lie? Does he really not know? Does he really not remember that he ever said that? Oh, yeah, young lady? Well, instead of insisting I changed my mind, why don't you ask me if I changed my mind? That's how you do an interview, he says. Oh, come on. She's being charitable, saying you changed your mind, dude. We all know what happened was you got down on your belly pandering, crawling before Sheldon Adelson and the Israel lobby, begging for them to hold their fire. I never said that. Yeah, you did. Anyway, Rand Paul, this is just going to be sad. And then, so now we can fast forward to the question. The question is, after he goes down in flames here, is he going to think, man, if only I had sold out sooner, faster. If only I had outright denounced and disavowed my father and all of his evil works back 4 years ago? Or is he going to realize that the reason people loved his dad is because of who his dad was, and that what he should have been doing this whole time was his best his dad impersonation instead of his Ted Cruz impersonation, or whoever it is he thinks that he's got to be to try to win? It's a tragedy, man. It is. That's the only reason I'm so set up. I'm so set up, I can't even say the word forward. It's the only reason I'm so upset is because I can imagine how it could be so easily otherwise, you know? It's the same thing about Bob Barr. Did I already use this one? Bob Barr, when he ran in 2012 after Ron Paul bowed out, but there's still the Libertarian Party. So then the deal is, of course, the candidate's got to be more libertarian than the most libertarian Republican that just finished running, right? No. Bob got up there and ran as Bob Barr, when all he needed to do was run as Ron Paul for a couple of months and do libertarianism some good. Otherwise, what was the point? To win or something? Same damn thing. Legacy wasted. Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America, columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at FusePowder.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Rafer Davis is going to talk about the murder of Walter Scott at the hands of this other cop. Not that Walter Scott was a cop. Rafer Davis, a former cop from South Carolina. He's going to be on the show in just a few minutes to talk about this. And this isn't some right-wing talk show where I've invited the apologist on to talk about what a dangerous job it is. You hear the truth. You got to attack the right from the right to make that point well, if you understand what I mean. All right. Hey, check this out, man. I like saying good things on the show when I get a chance to be positive about something. Dan Sanchez is now a columnist for antiwar.com. He's not just a contributor. He's a columnist right there in the right-hand margin with Jess Raimondo and Lucy Steigerwald and Ivan Elin. And, yes, we miss Kelly and Phil. And these are lean times for the anti-war movement with Democrats in power, you understand? But anyway, Dan Sanchez, he's young and talented and very Misesian. He teaches the Mises Academy there at the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. And he's a great writer, and he's really good on foreign policy. And he's got a brand new one. He's written a few blog entries for us there before, but this is his first standalone original piece that he's written as a columnist for antiwar.com. It's called The Herd Mind, The Ascension of the State in the Stampede of War. And it's, in a sense, a review of Randolph Bourne's essay, his unfinished essay, War is the Health of the State, which is actually part of a bigger thing that he was writing, just called The State. But he died in the middle of World War I before finishing the thing. But he got a lot of it written. And if you just search Randolph Bourne, War is the Health of the State, you'll really like it, man. It's great. It's kind of long reading, but it's good. And then here's Dan Sanchez explaining what he learned when he read it. Oh, I get it. War isn't just the health of the government. War is the health of that demonic idea shared by many men at once that now we've got to come together as a giant killing machine to fight against our government's enemies. That's the real problem. The poison in the minds of men that allow the government to do what it does. That's what's really meant by war is the health of the state. It's the control over the population that comes with it. And so, yeah, very much anticipating Orwell and that kind of thing. Randolph Bourne was. But anyway, so read this great article because it's about a great subject, about a great essay written by a great author and written itself by up-and-coming great libertarian writer Dan Sanchez, The Herd Mind. The Ascension of the State in the Stampede of War. I guess it was the spotlight yesterday on the show. Oh, no, it's not the spotlight. But still, it's really good. Right there in the right-hand margin under columnists at antiwar.com. And speaking of which, there's also a link right there in the viewpoint section to Phil Giraldi, and maybe I'll get him on later in the week about this. I didn't get around to inviting him today. But he's got a piece, and I think we already talked about this some, right? Didn't we in the last interview? About, well, so the Israelis were spying on the nuclear talks, huh? And by what all methods were they doing so? Because obviously the room would have been swept for bugs very thoroughly. And Phil here is speculating and wondering, I guess, out loud, kind of, about whether there were spies on the White House staff or on John Kerry's staff. I think he dismisses the idea that they were obviously simply the Israelis were spying on the Iranians, talking about the talks. They seem to have more than that. But anyway, that's called Who Did the Eavesdropping? That's at UNS.com by Phil Giraldi today. Very important to go and take a look at. All right. What time is it? Yeah. I guess I'll start talking about Iran real quick. We'll be back to this later on in the show. But I got in a Twitter fight with David Rothkopp from, I think he's the publisher, the editor, or the editor-in-chief, or something of foreignpolicy.com, about Iran and this new essay that came out, op-ed, in the Wall Street Journal by Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, both former secretaries of state, both Republicans, condemning the Iran deal and saying that Obama's letting the Iranians get away with murder. And so I don't have a full review for you, although maybe that is what I'll try to do later on in the show. But for now, suffice it to say, I think it's important to mention, they got it wrong right in the first paragraph. They call the breakout capability of 1 year, theoretically, of what it would take for the Iranians to have enough weapons-grade fuel to make a bomb, to the amount of time it would take to make a bomb, when in fact, that's a whole different question. They're making a simple gun-type nuke, then they need more uranium, and they're going to have a bomb so damn big that they're not going to be able to do anything with it. And then still they'd only have one. And if they're going to make some kind of sophisticated implosion device, then they'd need years of research and an entire Sandia National Laboratory equivalent that they don't have in order to figure out how the hell they're going to implode a miniaturized uranium or plutonium bomb. So breakout time just means how long it would take them to have enough weapons-grade fuel. Different question from a ready-made bomb. You don't just stick some plastic explosives on it and push the plunger or something. But anyway, and so they get that wrong in the first paragraph. So I got in a little bit of a Twitter war, and not too bad, with David Rothkopp from Foreign Policy last night. And I saw what's already happening, and Daniel Larrison has a great article about this at the American Conservative Magazine today, about how now the war party's moving their goalposts all over the damn place, and now the question no longer is, and you can go see the fight in my Twitter feed if you care, the fight no longer is this actually a good deal to limiting the Iranian nuclear program to such a degree that it undercuts all your whining about how afraid of it you are, when they're not making weapons-grade plutonium, never mind the fact that they don't have a reprocessing facility anyway. Facts never really seem to mind too much, so never mind that. But they're not even producing weapons-grade plutonium as waste anymore. They're not going to be when they reconfigure the Arak reactor. And they've agreed to half the number of centrifuges they already have spinning and limit the purity of their uranium-235 enrichment to 3.67% for their electricity program, useless for weapons purposes, to expand inspections to all hell and all this stuff. And so now, you know what? They realize they don't really have a credible argument for that. They've relied on vagary and innuendo so much for so long, they don't really have much to say to that. And so now they're saying, oh no, once the sanctions get lifted, now they're going to spend all that extra money on probably making bombs or giving it to Hezbollah and Hamas to terrorize the poor, innocent Israelis with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Moving the goalposts from how best to keep them from nukes to what might they spend the money on if we stop stealing it.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C., but those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So I don't know if you've seen the footage, but it's all over the internet. Guy named Walter Scott, shot in the back, murdered in the back by a cop from Charleston, South Carolina. And on the phone, well, the headline at the New York Times is, South Carolina officer is charged with murder in black man's death. Maybe the fact that he's charged is the most newsworthy thing here. But we got Rayford Davis on the line. He used to be an officer in South Carolina, and he's now a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. That's LEAP online. I think LEAP.org. Welcome back to the show, Rayford. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, Scott. Thank you. Yes, I'm a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. I'm speaking for myself today as a fellow police officer from the same department as Officer Michael Slager.
And how long has it been since you were there?
I was there from 2002 until 2007. I worked that very same area. As a matter of fact, I chased down a couple bad guys through that very same woodline cut.
Really?
That you see the video. Man, you know, I have my biopic from the police department. You know, my uniform and American flag, just like the one they're showing of him. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if he has my old badge number.
Man. So it could have been you, but you never shot anybody in the back to death in that same grassy area while you were chasing them. Why not?
Well, I came really close. I did. And it very easily could have been me killing someone in a similar manner.
All right. Well, so tell us that story then. Closest
well, I
you
had,
came.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I'll tell you one. I responded. We had a shots fired, somebody shooting in an apartment complex, and I saw the car approaching. The kid jumped out, black kid jumped, you know, we met eye to eye, and he jumped out of the car, ran through an old used trailer mobile home sales lot, and he was running through the woods, and he reached in down into his pants, and I'm watching him. I'm like, oh crap, he's gonna pull a gun, I know it. And you know, I stopped for a second. I drew my gun. I pointed it right at him as he was running. He pulled that pistol out of his hand and reached back with his elbow. And I could tell he, you know, I took all the slack out of the trigger. I was gritting my teeth. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to shoot this kid. And at the last moment, you could tell he decided not to turn around and square up with me. And he tossed the gun into the woods. He ran a good bit more, ended up catching him. It took forever to find that gun. I knew he threw it. I even put it out on the radio. He's got a, you know, we call it 1032. He's got a 1032. And you know, so it freaked everybody else out and they come flying, you know, and
well,
I would have ended up shooting the kid in the back. And hey, if we hadn't have found the gun, I would have been in a very, similar position.
All right. Well, yeah, maybe. Except this guy's caught on video planting the stun gun that he said the kid ran off with.
Yeah, right. And in no way am I trying to justify. That's just...
Yeah, well, I mean, this gets right to the question, though, is, you know, at what point, I mean, you held your fire all the way until he has a gun in his hand. You know he's got a gun in his hand. Yeah. You still haven't shot him yet.
Yeah,
Of aiming it at you, you didn't shoot him. So... It sounds like, you know, that's the standard, right? You don't shoot unless you have to. Not you shoot if you think you have an opportunity to kill somebody and probably get away with it, which seems to be the standard by which this guy was going.
You're absolutely right. You know, here's what I think. Maybe people get an idea of what he was not thinking. But when you train with a taser, you're taught that if you're disarmed and the subject attempts to use the taser on you, that that could be considered justification for use of deadly force. And so I think that's what he tried to poorly apply, is that he considered the guy hitting the taser away as, oh, he's trying to take it and use it on me. So not I can use deadly force, but I should. And it just all fell apart right there. And he never got out of that decision loop and followed through, even though it took him, a long time, which is a few seconds.
Yeah, I mean, and he's not even – he's just standing there like he's taking target practice, the cop is, just – you know,
yeah,
not...
he used good form, right? You know, I wish they had would train you a little more on when you should shoot someone instead of using a proper stance. This is your fear-based militarized training in your war on drugs in spades.
All right. Well, so now you were there in 2002. You said it's when you started. We had a war on drugs and at least the beginnings of a terror war then. Did you see the time that you were in there, things got more and more militarized, the cops became more and more like soldiers, or how do you fit into that time frame of your experience there?
I don't think much has changed. The neighborhoods I worked in right there, they've had problems since I was a kid in the 80s. Police officers have been working those neighborhoods and being aggressive in their traffic stops and trying to fight crime in a proactive manner. And this is the risk you run by following that type of policy.
And so
it's the same. It's the same. It hasn't changed. And it was that way when I was there.
Yeah, but see, I think that. This is kind of different than, well, the training is so bad. I mean, believe me, I think it's a problem when you dress these guys up in all this combat gear that they get to play in like they're Navy SEALs, and that's pretty bad and all that. But what we're really talking about is these guys are a bunch of thugs, and they're killers just like they were in the 80s and just like they were in the 90s and just like they were in the aughts, and now they are in the teens. They kill people when they think they have a chance to do it and get away with it. They take their shot. Just like this guy did. He wasn't in distress. He just stood there, propping up one hand with the other, pow, 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 until he got the heart shot. It seemed to me, just from watching, the most reasonable explanation is because he wanted to. Not because of any kind of training loop or anything. It was his chance to kill a guy.
Yeah, you think about that when you're kids and you play cowboys and Indians and, do you want a chance to kill somebody? No, it's a little more nebulous than that. You want to serve and test yourself. You know, I want to put myself in a dangerous position and come out, you know, as the cowboy in the white hat and, you know, face down the bad guys. And that's kind of what you believe in. That's why people join the military and the same way as law enforcement. And you have that type of a mindset. And that's kind of what I had. And I mean, you don't want to harm anyone unintentionally. You put yourself in that position.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the thing, though. Is like there's a stat that came out the other day where the cops in America have killed more people in 2015 than the British cops killed in the entire 20th century. Right. So,
wow.
There's something going on there where somehow these guys are able to protect life and property and get in a test of their manhood and come out okay without killing people day in and day out like it happens in this country. And I know the populations are different, but still, this isn't a difference of per capita, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. My big issue is as a law enforcement officer, you have to really fundamentally question what you are doing when you get out with someone and stop them. You're depriving them of their liberty. You're putting yourself in a position where you're going to use violence against them. You better make sure that they have actually committed some type of real crime that has actually harmed someone else. If this guy had, you know, taken a hatchet to a daycare center, you know, yeah, then we'd be having a different conversation.
Sure. Hey, can you do one more segment with us, Rayford, or do you got
to
go?
I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Okay, great. Hang tight right there. We'll be right back, y'all.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Rayford Davis. He's a former cop from North Charleston, South Carolina. And now he's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, just speaking for himself on today's show. And we're talking about the epidemic of police murders across this country, and more specifically, this story in the New York Times breaking from last night about this guy, Walter Scott, who was... He was actually even being charged with murder the cop who killed him is because of how blatant the murder is. They couldn't even spin this as a voluntary manslaughter or anything else. It's so blatant. You can look at the video probably all over the place now. Michael T. Slager is the name of the officer that murdered him. And so that gets to my next question right there. That seems to me to be the biggest part of this story. As we talked about, there are hundreds of people killed by cops already this year, and they almost always get away with it. The most newsworthy part of this is that a cop is being held accountable, and of course it's directly attributable to the fact that this video exists. Without it, he would have skated. He was already quite successful. And the police union and the lawyers and everybody were quite successful in getting his narrative out about how this guy left him no choice but to gun him down. And it's only because this very brave citizen stood there and filmed it with their phone and were able to get that footage out in a way it couldn't be buried, that this has even happened. But that seems to be, other than the personal responsibility and the choices of the gunman in this case, that seems to me to be the second biggest culprit here, is the sovereign immunity or the qualified immunity, in real terms, the impunity that the cops know that they have when it comes to this kind of thing, that they will be given such a benefit of the doubt that anyone that they come into a lethal conflict with like this will be condemned, will be presumed guilty, and that they just don't have any reason to fear the inside of a prison cell, no matter who they kill. And that's why this one is so shocking, more than just how clear the footage is, too. I guess that's a big part of it. But the fact that, wow, charged with murder, I saw on Fox News this morning, the expert said, this is unprecedented. So I wonder whether you think, I guess, first of all, if you agree with me, that's a big part of the problem here. And then I guess, secondly, maybe you think that this is changing. Is this an example of a change finally coming?
That whole sovereign immunity, your morality doesn't change when you put your badge on, and how, you know, you can be immune from laws that would make you a criminal if you were not a police officer. It's like, what do they call it, moral hazard.
Right.
It makes you put yourself more in dangerous positions. Let me stand up for, my leadership at that department. Even when I was there, they were very aggressive towards being fair with officers who broke the law. Man, I saw a whole bunch of them get charged with things that, you know, they tried very hard not to play favorites, and also were very concerned about the relationship with the minority communities, and worked very hard to do that. Of course, we'd have incidents like this that, you know, set you back, a long way. But so, I want to give props to them, for that. But yeah, that sovereign immunity is just to put you in these terrible positions that you normally would not be in.
Mm-hmm. And that economic phrase, moral hazard, that means like a bank being promised that they'll be bailed out no matter how bad of business decisions that they make or anything like that. Bob Murphy explained, where they pass seatbelt laws, people start driving more dangerously. So there's always that trade-off, that perverse incentive that gets built into how people operate. Well, let me ask you this, and this is something that, you know, I only ever actually hear this when I hear someone defining the supposed difference between a law enforcement officer and a soldier, and that is that a soldier's job is to destroy enemies, and a cop's job is to protect the rights of the bad guy, of the suspect. You're wanted for 10 counts of murder. My job is making sure that you get transported to the local jail cell safely so that you can stand trial and have a chance to, you know, confront your accusers and the rest of it. So, when that is the premise, I mean, assuming that that's the premise, that cops are ever even taught that at all, then it would seem to go hand in hand with that, that they're supposed to always use the minimum amount of force all the way up on the sliding scale and only use deadly force, never to enforce their will, but only to protect theirs or other innocent life, really, in an immediate and proportional sense, the same way that any other human has the right to use a weapon in lethal self-defense or in defense of another person in immediate and proportional self-defense, right?
Law enforcement pays lip service to that, but you're right. Not only is there militarized in equipment, but also a militarized mindset. Two important things. You almost treat it like when you're on a stop that you're storming the beach at Normandy, you know, and you move forward. Don't stop. You know, there's the enemy. You know, don't back down. And also just follow orders. You've got your orders. Go that way and don't stop. And that is inappropriate for law enforcement. And that has creeped in, and this is a result.
Yeah. I was sorry for repeating myself, audience, but I heard this one the other day where, I was reading in Facebook comments where people were complaining about one of these guys getting shot, and a cop was saying, "Hey, look, it's just like Iraq out there." And then the other people were saying, like, "Hey, man, all due respect, but no, it's not either. And I don't care, you know, what happened to you when you were in the infantry over there in the Bush years, but this is our hometown, man. And we're not Iraqis," as though, you know, that would really give them a right to go around doing what they do. But, you know, in context, you understand. But that he had to be told this by his victims in the civilian population. Apparently, his commanders never got around to saying, "Welcome home. Now you can put about 90% of your martial skills on the shelf. You don't need them here."
Yes. I also want to talk PTSD between military and police officers. When you harm someone like this, even when it's legally justified, a lot of these non-crime laws that you enforce, you cause moral injury to yourself by harming people. And even if you don't understand what you're doing, particularly like in enforcing drug laws, that type of thing, you harm yourself, and not dealing with that will cause damage to your moral fiber, a lot like when we don't recognize a military that fights wrongful wars.
I see what you mean. So, like, just helping the bankers kick the old ladies out of their house all day and enforcing, putting people in jail for owing on old fines and these kinds of things, you start to internalize, "I guess I am a son of a bitch, and that's why I do this. And here I thought I joined up to help people, but I'm helping the government at the expense of the people. But water under the bridge, now what am I going to do? Quit and get a real job?" And so now they internalize it and become the state themselves.
Well, you do, and people, and you're violating, natural laws of others' life, liberty, and property, and
that makes sense.
That causes moral harm to yourself. Anyway, the big deal: we criminalize vast amounts of nonviolent behavior, like drug use, gun ownership, child support, court orders, vehicle registration violations. It creates countless unnecessary police interactions and more opportunity for someone, citizen or cop, to be harmed. Citizens rightly fear oppressive unjust arrest and a never-ending crucible of jail-serving, fine-paying, court-appearing, warrant-issuing justice systems that serves no one but themselves. And police officers have to be aware. They're the ones that are going to face that moral burden. They're the ones that are going to face prison when they enforce these laws. And they have to take that personal responsibility themselves and reflect on what they deem to enforce. Just because your supervisor or the Supreme Court tells you it's okay, it might not be. And you're going to pay the price for it.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, right now they're on this rear guard action trying to ban videotaping them and this kind of thing, when the change that's really killing them is the cell phone video camera and Twitter and Facebook, where every local police abuse story becomes a national story, and the network news doesn't get to decide. The people's social media decides whether these are national news stories or not. And so that's a lot of pressure on them, in where they never had to feel it before. And so they're trying to criminalize documenting their crimes and this kind of thing. But so I wonder then, because I don't think that's going to hold, but so what do you think is going to happen, or what do you think that people can do? I admit I'm kind of frustrated. I see the race angle in it for sure, but I'm kind of frustrated. I'm terrible about these heartbreaks. Let me interview for another minute. I totally see the race angle on this, but I admit that I get a bit depressed when the main slogan is Black Lives Matter, when you mentioned lip service before to them being our protectors instead of our overlords. You know, any cop, any killer cop, would say, of course, Black Lives Matter. So that argument is one. But then the question is, what are we going to do about it, right? And so my best idea is state laws that say, and they're beginning along these lines in I think Wisconsin or Minnesota, I forget which, where, hey, if there's a controversial cop killing, then you have to bring in the DA from another county in the state. You have to bring in a special prosecutor from some other jurisdiction in the state who does not have a dog in these guys' hunt, who can come in. And I mean, there's got to be some kind of, we're not talking about, I wouldn't recommend federalizing every one of these as a civil rights prosecution, because that's a much higher bar in the first place. And it means many fewer instances of even attempted accountability. But I wonder whether you think of that, or what you think of that, or what kind of policies you recommend, or your organization recommend, that people can get behind something solid of what to do about it. Now, yes, Black Lives Matter. Now let's encode that in the law somehow, that it, where it sticks.
Removing sovereign immunity, period. Making a police officer liable and departments for their actions, and not just, hey, we meant well and we kind of tried to follow the law. Even if we didn't, we're still good.
Yeah, but you still got the local DA and the local grand jury that just love these guys and know them so well, and just that's such a perverse incentive right there, don't you think? I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm all for repealing sovereign immunity first, yesterday, you know, as soon as we can, absolutely. But
well, we have a state law enforcement that investigates every incident like this. So I'm not sure. May have been the Illinois Charleston Police Department that charged him, but it was probably a SLED. So we have an independent review
in
of
South
incidents
Carolina,
like this in South Carolina already.
Oh, that's good. Maybe that's a big part of why he's been charged.
And, you know, the murder charge, did he have malice? You know, I got to say he didn't. I know you're not going to agree with that. But, you know, I don't think he fired his gun in malice. And,
you know what it is? It's that last fatal shot. He pauses to line it up a little bit more carefully and then blam through his heart. You know? I don't know, man. It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And then the way he frames him up by dropping the stun gun next to him. Caught.
Yeah, I don't know about that. You know? That could be, once he's done what he's done, his brain in decision making was already clouded, and so after that, he probably doesn't even know what he was thinking or doing. And you're kind of trained to lay the taser down like that next to a subject when you go to handcuff him. So he may have just kind of been thinking in that.
Why would you be trained to drop your stun gun next to the guy?
Well, no, if you would set it down on the ground next to you. After the subject is compliant, and you can move in to cuff.
I see. As just because it's faster than putting it.
Yeah,
back
you got
to
watch. You got to watch those wires and everything. You can get it. You can get a little shock from them still.
Well, but I think go back and review this video. This is different because he goes over and handcuffs the body. Then he walks back over to the stun gun, picks it up. Then he walks back over to the body and plants it on him. It's just a drop gun type situation. Seems like pretty clear. But anyway,
it could be. But I'm not going to go that far and say that.
All right. Well, anyway, listen. I sure appreciate you coming back on the show and talking about this. I think. You know, the more other cops are willing to say, hey, we have a real problem here, that the citizenry are supposed to be the served, not the servants of our security forces and that kind of deal. Our rights come first. You guys are supposedly protecting them and all that. The safer people will be on a day-to-day basis because it's getting scary out there. And I don't think you have to be black to be terrified of cops. Not at all.
No, and I want to speak out to officers. Stop before you kill someone under these circumstances. This is, you know, horrible. And this guy's a young cop trying to do the right thing, and he has his life destroyed as well. And hey, Walter's brother, the victim's brother, said, "We don't advocate violence. We advocate change." When speaking about the community response to this, and let me turn that around a bit and say, it's law enforcement that advocates and uses violence every day. Law enforcement violence is the reason why you have rightfully lost the trust of your neighbors and citizens you swore to protect.
All right, y'all. That's Rayford Davis from LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and former cop in North Charleston, South Carolina. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so moving on with the news today. Yeah, I got a couple more police state stories for you. One of them is the guy in New Jersey that was mauled to death by the police dog, the German Shepherd. They got him on the ground. He's completely beaten down, already lost, and then just sitting there wailing on him and wailing on him. Sick the German Shepherd on him, and he died. I.E. He killed them. No, they killed him. Strike that and turn it around the other way, what I meant to say. They killed the guy with a dog. Like in Django Unchained. Maybe not quite that bad. But, well, he's dead, so yeah, that bad. And then one more in police state news. The U.S. secretly tracked billions of calls for decades. This is in USA Today. Is this really brand new? All right. The U.S. government started keeping secret records of Americans' international telephone calls nearly a decade before the September 11th terrorist attacks. We already knew that. We knew that back in the 1990s. All international calls, all the domestic landline calls, and 80% of the cell phone traffic. We've known that for years. I forget where I even learned that. Must have been from Bamford's articles back then. Anyway. Harvesting billions of calls in a program that provided the blueprint for the far broader National Security Agency surveillance that followed. Well, that's funny. Patriot Act wasn't passed until the year 2001. So where'd they get the authority to do it? When, of course, even the author of the Patriot Act says it never gave them such authority. They still use it that way anyway. There's a lesson in there for you about what laws say and how they're implemented. For more than two decades, the Department of Justice and the Drug Enforcement Administration amassed logs of virtually all telephone calls from the USA to as many as 116 countries linked to drug trafficking. Current and former officials involved with the operation said the targeted countries changed over time but included Canada, Mexico, and most of Central and South America. Federal investigators used the call records to track drug cartels and, yeah, whatever else they wanted to. I like this. They used it to help rule out foreign ties to the Oklahoma bombing. Yeah, really? Like Andre Carl Strassmeyer? Sure you did. I think they were talking about other kinds of foreigners they ruled out there. All right. So now, I guess back to the Iran thing, because this is such a big deal. I'm trying to do what I can to chip in, my little chip in toward the truth here. Create a little bit better atmosphere for this deal to go through. It's far from a sure thing. And, you know, and leave it to Barack Obama, too, when he actually has political capital to do something right. You ever heard of him following through and doing the right thing? So now he's facing the threat of the override of his veto on sanctions in the Congress that would basically undo the deal. That would sabotage the deal. Senate Dems undecided bill aimed at killing Iran deal. Veto override vote could hinge on a handful of senators, writes Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Planned vote on the Corker-Menendez bill, which would give Congress the power to kill any nuclear deal. I thought it was Kirk-Menendez and Corker somebody else. There are two different ones. Let me make sure here. Let's see. Oh, yeah, they do call it the Corker-Menendez. Did they merge the two together or something? All right, I guess I didn't know. Jason writes, the override is going to hinge heavily on Democratic senators, but two of them, Senator Chris Coons and Mark Warner from Delaware and Virginia, once presented as sure things by the bill's authors, now say they are undecided. The White House is warning that the Republican senators pushing the bill plan to use it as a political weapon in the future. That doesn't appear to be in dispute, but the focus of the bill is on sabotaging diplomacy with Iran, something which somehow seems to be less controversial. As the vote nears, expect heavy lobbying to continue on both sides, with the Israeli lobby pushing Democrats to kill the Iran deal at any cost, and the White House trying to keep the talks on track. And of course, you got the leader of the Senate, Democrats now, Chuck Schumer, is of course in on it with the Israel lobby against his own country, his own party leader, the president. And then this, Tom Cotton says, bombing Iran would take several days. It would be nothing like the Iraq War. In fact, it would be a cakewalk.
Peace. This president has a bad habit of accusing other people of making false choices, but he presented the ultimate false choice last week when he said it's either this deal or war. First off, he's the one that said for years, no deal is better than a bad deal, but he seems to have repudiated that position. Second, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said, the alternative to a bad deal is a better deal. And third, even if military action were required, and we certainly should have kept the credible threat of military force on the table throughout, which always improves diplomacy, the president is trying to make you think it would be 150,000 heavy mechanized troops on the ground in the Middle East again, as we saw in Iraq. That's simply not the case. It would be something more along the lines of what President Clinton did in December 1998 during Operation Desert Fox. Several days of air and naval bombing against Iraq's weapons of mass destruction facilities for exactly the same kind of behavior, for interfering with weapons inspectors and for disobeying Security Council resolutions. All we're asking is that the president simply be as tough in the protection of America's national security interest as Bill Clinton was.
Senator Cotton.
Okay, and so this is extra funny for people who get it for a number of reasons. First and foremost among them, by the time Bill Clinton bombed Iraq in December 1998, in Operation Desert Fox, first of all, it was blatantly an attempt to divert the impeachment hearings, which were scheduled, which had been voted out of the House Judiciary Committee and were scheduled to begin that day on the House floor. The debate over his impeachment. That was why he did it. And of course, if it was 1998 right now, that's exactly what Tom Cotton would be accusing him of. Correctly. Shooting Monica missiles to protect himself. Just like he'd done the summer before when she was testifying before the federal grand jury and he bombed a pharmaceutical factory, not an aspirin factory, an antibiotics factory in Sudan, condemning thousands of people to unnecessary deaths and blasting the empty sides of mountains in Afghanistan and turning Osama from a bandit into a folk hero there. So that's first and foremost. And then, of course, second and foremost would be that Saddam didn't have any chemical weapons in 1998. It was Bill Clinton who pulled the inspectors out, not Saddam Hussein who kicked them out. I don't care how many times liars tell you a lie, doesn't make it true. He pulled them out so that he could bomb them. And then he bombed a bunch of not chemical weapons because they didn't have any. Because as George Bush's weapons inspectors verified, Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction program, chemical, biological, or nuclear, after 1991. And that was all completely verified and known by 1995, and the UN was ready to certify them WMD-free by 97, which in chronological terms is before 98, you see. And then, so, yeah, Bill Clinton can bomb a bunch of nothing with ease in 1998 over a couple of days. How that translates into an air war over Iran, when Bill Clinton had been bombing Iraq, and they hadn't even shot down a single one of our planes for 7 years by that time. How that compares to the air over Iran? Oh, never you worry about that. Their SAMs are armed with candy and flowers to welcome us. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys. Here's one for your police state category. A Texas judge has been indicted on federal firearms charges? I think just for possession or something. I don't know the details yet. I don't know what's really going on there. Nobody thinks, well, the law is being applied, sir. He must have broken it or something. I don't know. Interesting. All right. Yeah, man, so I can't ever seem to get Mitch back on the show these days, but I'll tell you what he wrote here in McClatchy, D.C. Islamic State not only suspect in war crimes at Tikrit. Reporting from Irbil, Mitch Prothero at McClatchyDC.com. Iraqi forensic teams uncovered the bodies Tuesday of at least 40 victims of last year's massacre near Tikrit of government soldiers captured by the Islamic State in the early days of its onslaught across northern and central Iraq. And those graves are only the beginning. More than 1,000 Shiite Muslims are thought to have been killed after they were captured last year. The bodies of many can now be unearthed from the unmarked graves where they were dumped. But in the recapture of Tikrit last week, after a bloody month-long campaign also revealed new abuses. month-long campaign also has revealed new abuses that add to Iraq's nightmare by the mostly Shiite Muslim security forces and their Shiite militia allies. Even by Sunni Muslim allies of the government against Sunni residents, they accuse of backing the Islamic State. All the bodies found Tuesday had been bound and shot in the head.
An officer at the Saladin Provincial Command Center outside to Crete said the process of uncovering the hundreds of victims, yeah, etc. Skipping ahead to the current violence here. No, that's still the last year's violence being uncovered. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty damn bad. They did murder a lot of guys. You could watch it on LifeLeak, them massacring their captives last summer. But to creep back in government hands, however, now it's the government's allies who are under investigation, accused of widespread looting and prisoner executions. As security forces took control last week, journalists and civilians returning to the area witnessed widespread looting by both security forces and militias. Two local staff members from the Reuters news agency witnessed the summary execution of an Egyptian man accused of being an Islamic State fighter by a crowd of angry Iraqi policemen. Concern about Shiite militia behavior as they moved into a Sunni area was one of the reasons the U.S. withheld air support from the operation until Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi gave assurances that the militias would not enter the city itself as part of the final push. But the militias had heavy presence in the town after its liberation and were seen openly looting government buildings and private homes, as well as burning buildings belonging to suspected collaborators. You know, I really wonder whether... I don't know, man. It's really bad PR, as if assuming that the government in Baghdad has any control of this thing at all. They've got to wonder how in the hell they're going to be able to take Fallujah, which they claim is next on the list, or even, you know, finish. You know, they don't. I guess the Islamic State controls much of Ramadi, but not all of it. Maybe they could try to drive the Islamic State out of Ramadi, which is also a lot bigger city than Tikrit. I don't think it's as big as Fallujah or Mosul, though. But how are they going to do that when everywhere they go, they leave people fleeing for their lives, telling tales of the Shiite militias torturing everybody to death? And are they going to try to repopulate Tikrit with Shiites now and take it? Are they going to give it back to the local population? It's a big question, but... I'm amazed that they even tried this hard to take it, really. And, yeah, I don't know, man. This war's going to go on for a while. I admit that I thought that they would have had many more American forces on the ground there. That the political pressure in D.C., I guess, you know, part of it is that the worst war hawks in America admit, quote, "It is impossible to articulate a clear path to the desired end state." That's the Kagan clan right there recommending the introduction of 25,000 to 30,000 American soldiers to solve the problem. "We can't really recommend to you a course of action that will achieve what we want, but go ahead and put in 25,000 troops anyway. You know, so that they can get dead, I guess, and we won't look weak." These are the Kagans talking. "We won't look weak." And so I don't know, man. I guess because the worst of the hawks actually don't even have a line of BS they've been able to come up with to push yet. They can't help but admit the lines are so clear now that they would be intervening on the side of the Iranians. Just like they've been fighting against them in Syria. They would be back to George W. Bush's policy of fighting for the Iranians and their sock puppet militias, which they have been doing. Don't get me wrong. They did bomb the IS positions outside of Tikrit here and help with this current battle. But, and I know sometimes it seems like, well, they're obviously just playing the not very brilliant game of just playing all sides against each other. But, I think part of it, too, is they just don't have a coherent policy that they can carry out. I mean, the American people's enemies are the al-Nusra guys, and maybe if you stretch it, the ISIS guys. Really, the best solution to al-Nusra, ISIS in Syria, which is probably the most dangerous threat to us, the best solution to that problem is to do nothing. It's not to back Assad against them, but it's to sure as hell stop backing them against him. Quit turning them our way when they're busy right now. But the Iranians, they're not our enemy just because used to got hurt feelings left over from a coup that they had every right to do that revolution and overthrow the American-backed sock puppet fascist dictatorship of the Shah Reza Pahlavi in 79. And, okay, sorry about, I guess, your feelings for the hostages or whatever, but it was still 40 years ago. And you should know the CIA and the State Department were actually okay with the revolution in the first place because the Shah was dying anyway. And that was actually why they rioted and took the hostages, was because he came to America for medical treatment because Rockefeller and Brzezinski convinced Carter that we should let him in. He's our loyal sock puppet ally, and he's dying, and he needs medical care, and so let him into the country. He had cancer, did I already say that? And that was what caused the riot. That, see, he is just an American sock puppet, they all said, and they rioted and sacked the embassy. I'm not saying it was okay, but that was the context. But at first, the CIA and the State Department were like, hey, we know the Ayatollah. He's our old friend from 1953. He helped us overthrow the last government and install this guy. So, yeah, we could work with him. That's what the Israelis thought, too. They kept working with Iran all the way through the 1980s. That was why Reagan turned to the Israelis to sell them missiles in order to get the hostages released from Lebanon and make money to pay for the death squads in El Salvador and Nicaragua, right? Come on, everybody, keep up. But anyway, it's still the greatest irony of this current situation is that the Israeli lobby and their allies in D.C. are so hell-bent on their anti-Iran agenda that America can't help the Iranians really fight the Islamic State too bad. And so it's helping keep us out of this war, relatively speaking, of course. Lots of bombing from the air, but you know what I mean. My fear was the Marines would be there by now in the tens of thousands.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, you know, so someone sent me this interesting clip of Noam Chomsky being interviewed. And some the question was, why is the American right so closely tied to Israel? Tell us about the relationships, the money, etc. And Chomsky gives an overly long, complicated answer. He names a lot of things. I think he kind of dwells on some too long and whatever. Anyway, but the point is, the first thing he says is, you know, when you talk about the American right, you shouldn't really call them conservatives because they're not. They're radical statists in every way. And I doubt he knew it, but in a way he was sort of paraphrasing Murray Rothbard there when he explained that what was so bad about the socialists was that they turned liberalism into conservatism, basically. As Kolko put it, the triumph of conservatism when liberals adopted the conservative means of state regulation of the economy in order to advance humanity. Oops. And so the truth revealed there then, of course, is that who were the conservatives? They were already the statists. They were the ones who were the, loyal to the old order. And, you know, maybe to the newest old order. And so, but at this point, Chomsky's saying you can even leave out conservatism. At this point, it's not about conserving anything old and valuable at all. It's just about advancing particular corporatist or conservative Christian or Israeli or, you know, mostly corporatist agenda. And that they don't really have a conservative program to sell, just scare issues like gay marriage and prayer in school and this kind of crap. Yeah, fair enough points. But the thing is, what he said was that, well, one of the things I'd like to draw attention to that he said was that if we were talking about, you know, conservatives, there are a very small subset of conservatives in America, really, I guess. He probably was thinking of the American Conservative Magazine and how, in a sense anyway, their interest is conserving classical liberalism, what's left of it.
The only way, only reason we get classified with conservatives nowadays, libertarians do, is because the left is so statist on many issues, especially economic issues, that they make the conservatives look like free market types, when of course they never were. The socialists just became them, and then worse, along the same lines. And so then you have conservatives and libertarians agreeing, classical liberals, agreeing that the socialists want government way too big, even compared to the conservatives, who, again, were always the bad guys. But so just because they look limited government in certain circumstances and compared to the socialists doesn't make the conservatives a small government movement. They never really were. And maybe there's a small, you know, core of some kind of conservative movement. Say, I guess, you know, Danny McCarthy at the American Conservative Magazine, the Tory anarchist, he calls himself. That is a, you know, sort of a classical liberal conservation, you know, sort of a rear guard action to not give up the last of our revolutionary, our American revolutionary ideals, if you understand what I mean. But so, I don't know. Anyway, I like to confuse the hell out of people and then hope to, you know, provide a little bit of clarity in there about how these ideas switch around and what's left of the old right and all these kinds of things. That's Anthony Gregory's title to an article he wrote. To sort of provide some clarity about, you know, the libertarian political heritage, what this is really about. That's one thing I really liked about Jim Ostrowski's book about progressivism, was that he's saying he doesn't even like the word libertarian. He's trying to take back the word liberal because, of course, the socialists and the progressives stole the word liberal from the liberals. And that was why the liberals had to call themselves libertarians in the first place, was because the word had already been sullied by the Roosevelt types. And we were the opposite of that. You know, him being the conservative that he was, Franklin Roosevelt. So, but Jim Ostrowski says, no, we are liberalism. Because when we say we're libertarianism, then that means we go back to, like, the Second World War. Or right before it. But when we claim the real liberal heritage, then that means we're going back to all the great thinkers of the Enlightenment. And he names them. And explains. And then... And he's right, although it's an uphill battle. But it's true that if you ever meet a German, they say, the liberals here are the socialists. That's weird. And they're used to thinking of those things in opposite terms. Well, at least I've met Germans who've said that before, and other Europeans. Used to be a cab driver. Used to meet a lot of people for one-on-one conversations about these things sometimes. And, yeah, they understand liberal to mean libertarian. Free market type and live and let live type. Hopefully peacemonger, too. But anyway, if you're interested in these topics, especially if you're some kind of left-winger or right-winger, and you're interested in what is this weird libertarian snake oil this Horton guy's selling all the time, he is good on foreign policy, I gotta admit, you say to yourself, then I like to recommend to start a couple of Murray Rothbard essays. First of all, Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. That one's my favorite. You can find it all over the place. And you can find it in audio, by the way, read by the great Jeff Riggenbach, too. Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty. And then, I guess, second would be Anatomy of the State. And then third would be War, Peace, and the State. And then maybe after that would come Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy. And, well, get back to me after that. But that'd be a pretty good place for you guys to start reading some Rothbard. Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty, Anatomy of the State, War, Peace, and the State, Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy. Got all that? Okay, good. So that's about this libertarian stuff. And it was good to hear Chomsky actually kind of get that right. And then, by the way, the rest of the answer was, well, you have this kind of perverse millennialist philosophy. It's the premillennialists, right? Or the postmillennialists? The premillennialists, I think. Who they're trying to force Jesus' hand to come back and create the apocalypse while they're still alive and get to witness it firsthand, because that'd be really cool to see everything blow up, dude. And by the way, all the Jews except some die in the thing. But don't worry, everybody over there. Yes, they want an apocalypse, but no, they probably can't have it. And so they make for great rank-and-file Republican Party support on the Israel issue. That's one thing. And then Chomsky makes, I think, probably a bit too much of the strategic alliance, although he does point out a couple answers to the question, what has Israel ever done for us? He says that there was a time where when the Americans were bogged down in Vietnam, they wanted to check, I guess, the Syrians in southern Lebanon, and so they asked the Israelis to kick them out of there, something like that. I don't know. Didn't sound all that plausible to me. He said that we used them as an excuse to back the Egyptians to protect Israel from Egypt by bribing off their dictatorship when we have our own reasons that would generate less political support for paying the Egyptians such a high price in foreign aid and military aid every year. Something like that. Anyway, it's interesting enough. You could probably find on my Twitter feed where I retweeted it, and the tweet says, oh, go ahead and cue it up to half an hour into it or something like that. It's Chomsky's answer about why such right-wing support for Israel. And he does say at the end, he kind of forgets, and, oh, yeah, by the way, I don't mean to leave out Sheldon Adelson and the Israel lobby and the money that the Israel lobby brings to bear. And he could have emphasized, and I would emphasize, an organization. And I don't mean that in any kind of ridiculous protocols of the Elders of Zion kind of crap. I just mean phone trees, man. You know, when I was a kid, my mom was a member of the March of Dimes or whatever, where somebody calls her and then she calls the 15 people on her list and they're all supposed to call 15 people too and all this kind of thing for the March of Dimes. That's how the Israel lobby runs, you know, does business in this country. There are people who do the paperwork to keep track of which congressmen vote which way on which things and whether or not they are to be punished or rewarded in their next primary. And they get work done. That's a huge part of it. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, did you guys see this thing in the LA Times? The Pentagon's $10 billion bet gone bad by David Willman. And it's about, God, you look at the picture of this thing. They built a giant radar on a giant oil platform. They kind of hop, skip, and jump right past the journeys this thing made, being trucked all around the world. How in the hell did they get it through the Panama Canal? Did they go all the way down from Houston, all the way around South America to get it all the way up to Alaska, this thing? How much money did they piss away on this thing? Tens of billions of dollars. They're saying $2 billion, $2.5 billion on $2.25 billion. On this particular part of it. They talk about $10 billion, which has got to be a lowball estimate, of all the waste on all of the missile defense programs, which are almost all just a joke here. On this particular one, where it's the floating radar, they drug all around the damn world. That supposedly is supposed to protect us from North Korea, as though they could get a missile to Alaska. Come on. As though they could miniaturize their nukes and put them on a missile that could get to Alaska that they don't even have. They ended up just scrapping it after billions wasted on this thing. Oh, you know why? Because it could only see a tiny little piece of the sky at a time. Well, this is a great X-band radar right here. You can even, in theory, differentiate between a decoy atom bomb and an actual atom bomb breaking apart. Now we're assuming multiple reentry vehicles coming in from a North Korean ICBM that doesn't exist. Okay, as long as we're making up stuff, guys. And, this X-band, it's great. Except the problem is, it's, like looking at a war through a soda straw. That's even what they call it, a soda straw view of the sky. Meaning they'd have to already know what they're shooting down and plan to meet it there and all this crap.
And then they go through the airborne laser. Man, that looks neat. I remember all the propaganda when they were first dreaming that one up. Yeah, we're going to put these giant lasers on 747s. And then, oh, yeah, they would have to basically be already in enemy territory at the time that the missiles were being launched to catch them coming right out of the silos. And then, of course, the only countermeasure that the Russians would need, I mean the North Koreans or whoever would need, would be, I don't know, some chrome spray paint to deflect enough of that laser away. No big deal. Measure, cheap countermeasure. No problem. They finally just scrapped that after spending $5.3 billion. Then there was the Kinetic Energy Interceptor, which would, again, have to already be basically in enemy territory to work within range and was too long to fit on Navy ships in their storage. That was $1.7 billion thrown away on that one. The multiple kill vehicle, a cluster of miniature interceptors that would destroy enemy missiles along with any decoys. Oh, yeah, we'll just get them all. Force multiplier, nearly $700 million blown on that. And here's the thing about this. It's just a welfare program for the military-industrial complex. That's all it is, for people who are already rich. And what they do is they just dream up a bunch of crap, and then they just steal your money. They use the federal government to hold a gun to your head while they reach in your pocket and take it. And there's a great story. I told this one before because I love it so much. It's told by Andrew Coburn in the book Rumsfeld. How did Rumsfeld get the job? Did you know that Cheney Rumsfeld had a falling out? Rumsfeld tried to run for president in 1988, but Cheney was no dummy. He endorsed the vice president, George H.W. Bush, and landed himself the job as Secretary of Defense out of the deal. But Rumsfeld, his old boss, was really hurt. Oh, man, you didn't endorse me? Well, now I don't like you anymore. And so they didn't really talk too much and weren't really friends during the 1990s there. But then what happened was Dan Coats, the senator who's now finally resigning, senator from Missouri, he was Bush Jr.'s first pick, I guess maybe Colin Powell's choice to be Secretary of Defense, maybe his father's choice or James Baker's choice or something. And he came in, and during his job interview, he said, oh, come on, we're going to do the missile defense thing. Everybody knows that'll never work. It's just a giant waste of money. And they said, yeah, right, well, that's kind of the point, dude. So don't call us, we'll call you. Thanks very much. He flunked his job interview because he objected to the actual purpose of the missile defense system, which is to steal with a pretext. That's it. And so then Dick Cheney said to Bush, here I am just killing my punchline here. Then Cheney said to Bush, well, I know a guy. He was already the Secretary of Defense in the Ford years. You might remember him parodied in the movie Heavy Metal. The dead-looking guy who's the Secretary of Defense there. His name's Donald Rumsfeld, but I warn you, your father hates him. And Junior said, really? Great. Bring him on in. Let's get him. Because it was Rumsfeld when he was Ford's chief of staff who banished Bush Sr., who he saw as political competition to himself, to be the head of the CIA, which was thought at the time of, the church hearings and all that to be political suicide for the guy. Once he's the head of the CIA, he'd never be able to run for president against Rumsfeld. When his turn came, he thought. But anyway, so that was a funny little story about how Rumsfeld got the job and how Dan Coats didn't get it. He didn't get it because he objected to just outright robbing the American people blind, like in this the Pentagon's $10 billion bet gone bad. And I don't think this is comprehensive of the whole program. I think he's just talking about a subset of the missile defense program that was meant to be rapid development of new, wide, and varied technologies and ways of doing things and whatever, where they just threw $10 billion away just on that. So I don't think this is even meant to be comprehensive. But it's a great read. It's full of great information. It's at the LA Times. You don't have to get around a paywall or anything like that. It's called The Pentagon's $10 Billion Bet Gone Bad by David Williams. And I tried to get him on the show, but he didn't answer me. But I don't know why not. I'm such a great interviewer. I don't know. Maybe you heard the show. Maybe he looked at my Twitter feed and was like, Jesus, this guy comes on pretty strong. Anyway, the Pentagon's $10 billion bet gone bad by David Willman. Did I say it wrong? David Willman in the LA Times. All right. And then, oh, cool. I still have time to say other things. So I'll talk about Afghanistan. Soldier killed one American soldier and wounded two more. In Afghanistan, another green on blue attack, meaning friends on our guys. They renamed them insider attacks. I guess the focus group said that I was a bit more confusing, so they decided to go with that, something like that. And, you know, this is what William S. Lind called the operational art. There's the strategy, there's the tactics, and there's the operational art of warfare. And the Taliban, they've got their act together. They figured out all they got to do is just put out word that, you know, what we'd really like is for guys on the inside to turn on their American friends, to double cross them. And what we'd really like is for guys who would like to do that to go and join up, pretend to join the army, but be a double agent. And then when they're not looking, shoot them. And it's just a small thing in practice, you think about it, but it means that the soldiers are not safe on their own bases. And that's how they feel about it. And it's a great terror tactic against their morale. It works. And that's why they keep doing it. And here we are, 14 years in, 13 and a half years into the war, and we lost it. Which, in fact, reminds me of this other great essay that I think I had here somewhere. Maybe I lost it now. But you can find it at tomdispatch.com. It's an excerpt from, it's really worth your time, too, man. I know I recommend lots of reading here, but go to tomdispatch.com and look at this thing. It's an excerpt out of Anand Gopal's book, No Good Men Among the Living. And he talks about how these guys who never were Taliban, but who, of course, tolerated their presence because they had no choice, had become the Americans' friends for a couple of years anyway after the invasion occupation. But then the Americans just needed people to fight and so picked a fight with them and turned this whole group of willing collaborators into enemies. Started calling them the Taliban and killing them even after they'd been kissing our ass the whole time. And, well, you'll shake your head. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.